Hello and welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. I'm your host, Willem Vanderhorst. Thank you very much for tuning in. It's been a couple of weeks already since the last episode. We have an exciting guest tonight. I had a fantastic conversation with Jessica Greenwood. Jess Greenwood, I believe she goes by Jess usually. The co-chief strategy officer of RGA. RGA is a digital agency based out in New York. Although, I mean, they have offices in a few different places around the world. And they are a fantastic agency, really well known for a lot of the work they've done with really big brands such as Nike. And we had a really fun conversation with Jess. She used to be a journalist. And we start out the conversation talking about her Twitter bio, that she's a proponent, an enthusiastic proponent of enthusiasm that I really, really liked. So that just tells you something about the level of energy in the conversation that we had. It was just, enormous amount of fun. We talk about writing, we talk about journalism, we talk about strategy, we talk about advertising, a lot of different good stuff, and about Jessica's life and how she got to where she is now and a few of her adventures on the way. As you know, that tends to be the kind of focus that I have. I'm interested in the stories behind the interesting people that tend to do this kind of job in strategy. I hope the sound is not going to be all that too different. I'm recording in a different environment, not the same room where I usually record at the moment, and not with my usual microphone. I'm just recording straight up from my computer. Generally, it just records fairly well, obviously not as well as my computer. I normally have my travel microphone with me, but when I'm traveling, but which is kind of what's going on right now, not exactly. I'll come back to that in a later episode. I don't have it anywhere. I don't know if I lost it or anything. I don't know where my mini mic is at the moment. But that's not really here nor there, as it were. So what else is going on? Things are going well in Chicago. I've been really busy with a lot of work and a lot of more unexpected work that piled on. Hence, excuses and apologies for being late for the website, the podcast publishing. Another side note, I can't remember if I mentioned this in the last intro because I think I just did it very quickly, but I wanted to mention it here now. I'm thinking about experimenting and doing something a little bit different for the podcast, because I've noticed that while I really, really enjoy the conversations that I have with the guests, as you will hear later, and those kinds of conversations, particularly if you've been listening to the podcast already, but it seems like there's more and more people in advertising that are catching on to podcasts and doing interview styles, conversation style interviews the same way I'm doing, basically with guests. Either directly in strategy, such as Mark Pollard's Sweathead podcast, which is fantastic. Check it out if you haven't, but I'm sure you have. I mean, if you're a strategist and you listen to this. If you're in gaming, you might be interested in how to market your game, so you might be interested in checking out that podcast for that reason. Because Mark really digs into the craft. How do you do strategy? How do you communicate? How do you present a brand? And he talks to a lot of different people in the industry. And I've noticed a few other people that have started talking to chief creative officers, more higher up / quote unquote famous people within the advertising industry, which I guess I don't really count myself as one of those. I have, you listening right now. And I joke about that with Jess in the episode that is essentially, I know that my dad listens to the podcast because he gives me regular feedback about it. So, it's not like I have a curated niche audience, I'd like to say. but that said, I am looking at always ways to pull together the two biggest audiences that interest me the most, which is the job that I do in strategy and advertising, creative communications, that world altogether. And I know it's broad, but still. And the other big world that I really like, which is tabletop gaming. And that is also a broad world, but if we have to focus on creative communications, I tend to focus on strategy. And if we have to have a focus on tabletop games, I tend to focus on storytelling and role-playing games. And I use those in workshops, and I'm way behind on structuring a lot of that writing, and I eventually want to put together some kind of box set or product with a lot of the methodologies I test and want to use in branding workshops. But one of the things in the meantime, I thought, well, I've talked about role-playing games and tabletop games with strategists, And I participate in a lot of games on Kickstarter that I don't really get to play on a regular basis because I'm busy with a lot of other things. So, and I'm trying to find ways to bring those together. So the experiment is, what if I actually introduced tabletop role-playing games to people who work in creative communications? And there's a trend going on in gaming podcasts, which is to record sessions. So for live play, similar to what you have broadcasting on Twitch, or some others are edited, which is probably the direction I would go in. So I would record a whole gaming session, then edit it down to the interesting, most interesting or entertaining bits, and then have a subsequent conversation with the people that I played with and intertwine that. And I will credit, I mean, there's a bunch of other people, but I will certainly credit Callum from The Rollists podcast, The Rollists, that is a gaming, geek gaming based podcast based in London. And Callum's a friend and he has a fantastic podcast I really, really love. He puts a lot of time and effort into the editing of his podcast, and it's a pleasure. I recommend checking it out, and I'll put the link in the show notes. So yeah, please get in touch. Send me an email. My email is Willem, W-I-L-L-E-M, at icecreamforeveryone.net. That's everything spelled out. If you want to find the rest of my stuff online, that's at the website at www.icecreamforeveryone.net. And as I usually do, a little bit of quick promo at the same time. And the promo is essentially for more people to listen to this. Back to my point about, you know, I don't have a small curated niche audience. But if you know maybe one other friend that would enjoy this conversation, please send it over to them. Also, just because it encourages me usually to hear feedback or to hear that you're enjoying the show. Somebody messaged me through LinkedIn this week to say that they really enjoyed the show, and it was a great pleasure to hear from them. Even better if you can post a review or thumbs up on your favorite podcast app. So that means iTunes and the Apple podcast app. I know it's not really, they don't make it very, very easy to leave reviews. But if you go into iTunes, you can. And I'm hoping they're going to streamline things based on their announcements that I still haven't caught up. I can't remember the Apple announcements about iTunes that is changing. So a good thing this is not a tech podcast, because I know that was coming up, or maybe it was yesterday. I'm not exactly certain. Anyhow, yeah, you can also tweet at me. My Twitter handle is icvillem, like ice cream, or letters I-N-C-W-I-L-L-E-M. You can find me everywhere you can find me, basically. I'm participating in the conversation. Even though I'm not tweeting or sharing all day, every day, I do check out my messages, my email, and I reply to people in as timely fashion as I can. That's about it. I'm going to stop rambling for now and let you hear the conversation I had with Jess. Enjoy. Hey, Jessica, welcome to the show.
Hi there. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for joining. I really appreciate your taking the time.
Of course.
Cool. So let's see. We were just talking about this, and I made some notes, some preparation, but I thought to start with, I thought that seemed like I liked the sentence, and I liked the first sentence on your Twitter bio, an enthusiastic proponent of enthusiasm.
Yeah. This is, do you want me to, like, I can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
So generally, I find that working in the industry that we work in requires a lot of optimism and a lot of energy. Because it's very easy. The world is very complicated right now. The projects we're trying to do are complicated. Getting good work made is hard. And we have to increasingly get different skill sets and people with different skill sets to work together in order to achieve things. So my general MO is to be enthusiastic as possible and to assume that everything's going to go well until it doesn't. And I think I had a friend say to me once, he's a psychologist, and he said that you can show up to every meeting, you can be the bringer of serotonin, which is the happy hormone, or you can be the bringer of cortisol, which is the stress hormone. Like, which one do you want to bring? And so my job is to be the bringer of serotonin in as many contexts as possible, whilst also making sure that the work's good.
That's great. And I think this is a really great example about the bringer of serotonin versus cortisol.
Mm-hmm.
Was it? Yeah. But I also think sometimes people don't feel that they have the choice. Is there anything that you do or practice that you feel kind of like helps you keep that level of enthusiasm?
I think I'm in the right job. I think it's, yeah. I think you, if you're finding it really hard to muster up enthusiasm, you might be in the wrong job. And I think the thing that I love about my job now is that it is never, ever boring. It's hard. And sometimes it's painful, but it's not ever, I am never bored by my day. So I think, and that makes it very easy to go from room to room and be like, okay, this is interesting. How are we going to solve this? I think it, there's a sort of, there are people who are naturally more upbeat and people who are naturally more downbeat, but, if you're in the right situation and if you're sort of happy, if you're happy doing what you're doing every day, then I think it's, you have a sort of moral responsibility to bring as much enthusiasm as possible to that work.
That's perfect. Well, and just talking about the work, just to make sure that people are tracking and following us, because a lot of the people who will be listening work in advertising and strategy or creative communications, but mm-hmm. there are definitely people who come across the show who don't, like my father.
Hi, Dad.
So can you just give us the brief overview of who you are, what you do, and how you describe what you do?
Yes. So I am Jess Greenwood. I am the co-chief strategy officer of RGA US. So I have six offices across the US that me and my partner Tom look after. And our job, depending on the day, we either describe ourselves as, depending on what we're working on, as making the outside world real for the client. So we represent a perspective on the world that is fundamentally very important because particularly in America, like the clients that we have here are so enormous and it's very hard for them to understand what's actually going on in the world. And then our new stated purpose at RGA internally, this is the thing that we talk about to our teams, is to make the future more human, which I love because we're working on an enormous amount of new economy companies. We work with a lot of Silicon Valley companies. We work with a lot of companies that didn't exist 10 years ago. And those are the companies that people can feel slightly nerve-wracked about. So our job as RGA, and particularly as the strategy team at RGA, is to sort of come together to make the future more human.
Great. Perfect. What are some of the large brands that you work with on a regular basis?
So I'm picking through the ones that we can talk about. Our biggest one.
Yeah, sure. Of course.
Our biggest ones are, Samsung, Verizon, Nike, Google. We have, Ally Financial. We have DuPont. We have, a few that we're super conflicted on, some very famous, daily usage, Silicon Valley companies that we're not allowed to talk about. We also do a lot of Pepsi. We have an enormous spread of clients. Pepsi, Walmart, just everybody.
Yeah, clearly. No, just those few names is perfectly enough to get like the
gist of it.
The scope illustrating what you meant by very large companies that are dealing with a lot of things.
Yeah, we do a lot of work with the sort of medium sized ones as well. But I think it's our work involves flexing from very large and complicated organizations to very small and nimble organizations, and they have their own degree of disorganization at each stage. So our job is to help them.
Great. Perfect. So yeah, I usually like to go back a little bit. So obviously you're from the UK, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Liverpool. I grew up near Liverpool, and I'm extremely happy to report that we made the semi-finals of the Champions League last night. So I think...
I know. Apologize. No. But I have one of my best friends who just recently moved to Liverpool who studied over there and lived there for years, and her and her husband just bought a house. I went to visit them last summer and was my first time visiting. And I know she's very, very, very excited about the championship right now. She's been following very closely.
Yeah, well, there's the Premier League and the Champions League. They're having a good season. So we'll see. They are also known for spectacular collapse. So we'll see how it goes. But for now, we're optimistic.
Do you still keep following the team even though you're in New York now?
Yeah, like America's has glommed onto the Premier League in all sorts of ways. So you can watch all the games, and it actually works better here because it means I get up on Saturday morning, I watch the games, and then I can get on with my day rather than having to take an entire game and day out to watch a football match. But yeah, I think it's my husband's Canadian, and we did a great sporting exchange where I sort of explained football and cricket to him, and he explained baseball and basketball to me. So. It's quite a big sports household.
Perfect. And so what kind of a household did you have growing up around Liverpool? Was it just like in the very urban, suburban, siblings?
Kind of suburban. I actually grew up on a strange peninsula near Liverpool, which is called the Wirral, which no one's ever heard of. And it's a kind of an interesting place to grow up because it's bits of it are sort of mostly villages and fields. And then other bits of it are extremely sort of urban and industrial. And it was close enough to Liverpool. It's actually kind of awesome place to grow up because it's close enough to Liverpool to get into trouble as a teenager, and far enough away that you weren't ever kind of We never went quite as far off the rails, but it was, it was a great place to grow up. And I think I've been traveling. I haven't been there. I turned 40 this year, so I haven't been.
I do too.
I've been away for longer than I was there now.
Yeah, right.
I left when I was 18, so it's been a while.
Yeah. And when you left, did you go, is that when you went, because I understand you studied in Birmingham, was that around that time? Or?
Yeah, no, I went to Italy for 2 years. I was in Rome for a year and Bologna for a year. Then nice. I got my degree in
studying that. Or just purely traveling or?
Both. I was an au pair for a year and learning Italian. And then I worked in a bar in Bologna because I fell in love with a boy, did a bit of studying and then went to France for a year as well. So I sort of, and then after that, got my degree, moved back to London, and then from London to New York 8 years ago.
And I know you started, I mean, I think you did a few other things before, I'm not sure, but I know you worked in journalism as a journalist. Was the writing, were you already writing, like growing up or before you worked as a journalist?
I thought I wanted to be a journalist, and then I sort of realized how, I think the people who were really serious about being broadsheet journalists had figured that out sort of ages ago and had started sort of when they were 12 figuring out exactly how to get on that career path. And I sort of ambled around it and into it sideways, as a lot of my career decisions actually tend to happen by accident. But the so I basically ended up writing for a magazine. I got a job in London writing for a magazine. The first one was a sort of smaller one about film production, and then I got a job writing for a magazine called Contagious, which started in 2004, I think, and was specifically designed to look at all the changes in branding design and technology and popular culture that were happening because of the internet and because of all these kind of new tools that were available to designers and marketers. So I got it by accident, but loved the writing and then realized later that journalism and strategy are essentially the same thing in lots of ways, in that you have to do a bunch of research, you have to find the most interesting thing about that research, and you have to communicate it in a way that makes people want to take action off it. So I didn't know that I was a strategist, but when I sort of came to RGA, it took me a while to figure it out. I was like, oh, I seem like one of you guys. Like, this seems like the most natural fit for my brain. So I'm slightly haphazard in my approach to my career, but it's worked out well.
Did it feel like coming home then a little bit, or...?
When I went to an agency or like...
Yeah, when you moved into strategy, finding out that, oh, actually, I can do all of those things. This seems to be the same skills.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. So I went to RGA because I interviewed the founder for a piece. And I was like, this company's flipping amazing. They're trying to do all this crazy stuff. And they brought me in and they weren't really sure where I fit. And I wasn't really sure where I fit. And I was just really lucky that they gave me the latitude to figure it out. And there was a sort of strategist here at the time who I just wanted to, she was the coolest person I'd ever met. And I just wanted to follow her around and copy what she did. I was like, I sort of imprinted on her like a baby duck and just realized that her way of thinking about the world and mine was that my brain was capable of doing that. And I was really lucky to have the latitude to make that career transition. And I think those kind of career transitions are something that the industry always says that they're enabling, but they're harder to pull off than they look because you have to give people latitude and time to be bad at the job whilst knowing that they're going to get better. And they gave me that. It was awesome. They gave me 6 months to be bad at my job. And by that point I was off to the races. So it's great.
That's very cool. And it's interesting that you mentioned that idea that the person you're following around, I know that the idea in the conversation of having a mentor is one that's bounced around and talked about quite a bit in this industry, certainly by strategists, possibly others. I mean, it exists in other industries as well, but I don't know if it's as much in other industries or because I'm in this one and I hear that a lot. But did you find that also quite a common, like, recurring theme of the benefit of having a mentor in this industry?
Yeah, and I do. I think it's mentors. I would never have described her as my mentor necessarily, but she was, but I guess she did fill some of those roles. It was more that, like, she let me watch what she was doing and she answered. So I think mentorship is, maybe this is a mistake in the mentorship field. Mentorship, I think, is often involves like advice on how to like build a career and how to kind of connect you with opportunities. She was like a very craft-based mentor. She showed me how to be a strategist and she was patient when I talked about, like when I tried to talk things through with her and like when I talked about the challenges I was facing with specifically with like client briefs and brand problems. And like that kind of mentorship is hard to come by because it requires a huge sort of time investment from people, and it requires like a lot of patience, like letting somebody get to things by themselves that you could probably solve for them. And it was very hands-on, and I'm entirely grateful for it even now. So
yeah. Now, it's interesting because I had the same kind of or similar kind of experience anyway, and I was thinking about that as you were talking and sharing about it, because I came from a different background, and the first two directors and senior strategists, I'm grateful that they spent a lot of time with me, giving me the time to learn the ropes and actually showing me the craft as well. Same. Yeah.
I mean, that's great. And like, we don't all get that. Like it is an unbelievable privilege, I think, finding those people.
Yeah, no, it is. Back to journalism. I was thinking one thing, and this is a topic that you talked about a few times, and it's great. I was thinking just a little bit more for any strategists that are listening to us, talked about the natural kind of moving, using the skills of journalism to move into strategy. And if we think now, are there skills that you know from journalism that you think could be quite practical or useful for strategists to learn or practice and learn from?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh man, like let's talk about this. This is one of my bugbears. So the big rub on strategists is that they prefer to be clever rather than helpful. And I think in journalism, you can't get away with sort of obfuscating with cleverness. You have to be like pretty direct about what it is that you're saying. And you have to learn to sequence a story in a way that makes everybody exactly follow what your thread is, understand exactly what you're trying to say. And so I find sometimes our strategists, they have the nuggets, they have the kind of insight, they understand what they're trying to do. But it takes a while for them to be able to sequence that story in their own head. So it's a very, very logical story from like, we did this, we got here, we learned this, and so you should do this. And it is something that I've never, my brain is an editor's brain. Like my brain, I can look at decks and stories and strategies and understand what isn't relevant and what isn't in the right order. And that was learned from like, writing my own stuff and then like editing other people's, like looking at writing and thinking, right, you've buried the lead here, this isn't right, this is not the most interesting thing about this story, it needs rewriting in this direction. And like that has served me. That is an extraordinarily I didn't know that it was an advantage at the time. I think one of the things that journalism is good at is telling everybody that like the works in it that they have zero transferable skills. Like the only thing that you know how to do is write articles and publish them. And like that was the 6 months when I came to RGA, and it took me a while to figure out what strategy is. I was just like, oh, I know how to do this already. Like I absolutely do. The output is different. Your output is a brief or a deck or a sort of client briefing or shaping the work in some way, but it is exactly the same thing. And it's tingling exactly the same bit of my brain. So I think everybody should learn. Strategists who can't write, I have a hard time with anybody who's a strategist who has a hard time being able to write.
Yeah.
Some of us are more natural kind of long form writers than others. Some like are happier in the short form space. But like, if you genuinely can't string a story together, that's a problem. That's going to be an issue for you as a strategist. Yeah. So, does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And do you think that's something that can be improved on or picked up, say, with a creative writing or a writing course of some kind, for example?
Maybe. I think we just need to make the point. I think we just need to say to people that, look, the order in which you communicate things is going to reveal to you which of those things is the most important. Because if you're just sort of meandering around the garden path with all these facts that you've uncovered, no one's going to know what to do. And like we sort of make our strategists do... you know, it's like a problem right now when we're reviewing work. They'll come with people will come with their stuff pinned to the wall, or they'll come with like a deck, and everyone will sort of like meander around the details. But you can only see what the story is when you stand up and try and present it, or stand up and like try and tell the story sequentially. And then you see, oh, actually, that doesn't work. Those aren't connected. That isn't the right thing. So, and we're doing a sort of... as we go to a sort of more data-led world, I think, and the sort of signal-to-noise ratio gets a little bit more confusing, I just think this is something that we need to talk about more. I don't think it's made clear enough to strategists entering the industry that, like, you are a storyteller. You've got to tell a story in a way that, like, is irrefutable.
Great. Perfect. Talking about a story, and this is kind of a poor segue, but anyway, I'll do it anyway. So there was one video I watched in which you were giving some advice, and you mentioned having and this was probably your previous career, I think, introduced George W. Bush at a conference. Oh, yeah. And it was a brief answer. So I was like, wow, that sounds like a really interesting story. Could you share what happened there?
It was nuts. It was, so my job at Contagious is, it was the best job that anyone's ever had throughout their 20s. And I am so, so lucky to the like people there, to Paul Kent Robinson, who founded it, and like he was a mentor still, that they gave me that opportunity. So basically, Contagious managed to ride an incredible cultural wave in that they were talking, they were the only publication really talking about sort of changes in the ad industry, innovative exercises in branding, design, technology, and popular culture at a point where everyone was really trying to put their finger on the ways that the internet was changing the world, both the ad industry and the sort of culture that it feeds off of. So what that ended up meaning was that not only that we were writing for this magazine, but that I set up the Contagious Consultancy while I was there, and a large part of the business was us flying around the world, explaining to people how their categories were changing, what cultural forces were at work on their brands, what sort of consumer sort of technological solutions were coming up that they should know about, and then also positioning within that cultural context all of the like amazing work, like advertising work and like branding work that was being done as a result of it. So I spent most of my 20s on a plane, like in like Hong Kong and Sydney and, you know, all these Berlin, like all these just crazy, wonderful places.
That's awesome.
Telling people like 1,000 times older than me, not 1,000 times older than me, sorry, that sounded rude, but I basically had like a lot of imposter syndrome because these are very experienced people and like you had to go and speak to them all, and it was kind of amazing. And as a result of that, I got picked up. There's this sort of wonderful organization called the World 50, which is shadowy and a very behind closed doors sort of exclusive environment for high profile industry sort of big hitters. And they asked me to come in and do a presentation. I did quite a few presentations for them over the course of the years. And these are sort of members only events. They're very select. There's sort of 50 people there. They're all CMO, CEO level. And so I did a couple for them, and I did one for the CMO group, and they said, actually, would you mind just coming down the road to do like 10 minutes for the CEOs as well? Just come and, you know, I was in New York, and they were like, do you mind just coming to talk to this other group? And I'm like, no, that's fine. And then, so I went to do my presentation as I was there, and they were like, oh, you know, we should tell you who's on after you. And it's George W. Bush.
Wow.
And I was like, and I was 28 years old. I was just like, this is surreal. So I basically had to, I was sort of giving my presentation and then had to sort of hand over to say, you know, okay, well, I'm wrapping up now. So you guys can hear from, you know, where was he? 43, like, you know, President George W. Bush. And it was just this moment of complete, I think about it now and I'm still kind of, in person, he's an extraordinarily charming man, which is, you know, I think realizing that at the time was kind of a heresy, but given the stage that we're up to with American politics right now, George Bush, I think people are revising their opinion of George Bush.
Some people are. Did you have a chance to have a talk with him or hear what he was saying after you? Or
yeah, like we sort of sat, the Secret Service came in and we sat and listened to him, and he's a, you know, he's a good old boy. He's like the most interesting person at a dinner party in Texas. He's like a very kind of charming person. And he talked about, he addressed the things that he talked about were how he got, you know, how he managed in office, knowing that sort of public opinion of him at certain points was incredibly low, and, you know, what he's kind of struggled with. And it was fascinating. And like, as somebody who's sort of skews extraordinarily to the left, it was hard for me to see him be as a human being. You know, he's a human being. They are human beings, and they are flawed and interesting. But I had spent, as a European, I had spent the 8 years of his presidency wondering how the hell he got elected, and then I spent 20 minutes listening to him, and I was like, okay, I kind of get it now.
That's brilliant. And I think the point about getting to see people and human beings as human beings, as corny as it might sound, I don't know, there's something about that. There's just, I think there's a key in terms of communication and listening to each other that might have a way forward to solving some of the divisiveness going on.
Yeah.
Even though it sounds really general, but, you know.
I think it's true. But listening to each other is one thing. But like the thing that I feel like we've lost right now is the idea that caring about other people is a fundamental part of humanity. Like that worries me a little bit. It's not that people aren't listening. It's that they don't care. And like, they don't, you know, they don't want to hear the other side because they don't think that the other side are people that are worth worrying about. And like,
that, and increasingly, we don't need to hear the other side because we're just like served our own silos of opinions.
The algorithms, it's we're in a sort of extraordinary period of time. I was listening to something the other day where I'm not going to get sort of too political about this.
No, sure.
Whatever your opinion of the current administration in the US, it won't be around forever. Like, it might be 2 years, it might be another six. We don't know yet, but the big problem that we have after that is basically the sort of this both divisiveness and then also like people's complete inability to assess realness in the media that they're consuming, and the sort of fake news and all of the myriad insidious ways in which that's affecting society. Like, fake news is becoming like a much more catch-all term than just fake news, I think, right now.
Actually, this is perfect because I was thinking about a question in this particular area. I called it a media chicken and egg question, basically. And it's exactly the kind of stuff we're talking about. And I was gearing specifically towards the amount of the mainstreamness or popularity of what used to be, or at least I thought used to be, fringe beliefs or conspiracy theories. Yeah. And I listened to an episode of This American Life recently that came out, the podcast, about talking about different of those trends. Another one that's coming out to be big is thinking the earth is flat. And, yeah, you know, there's mainstream article news and apparently an increasing number of people that believe that. But I don't know. But then the chicken and egg question is like, do you think, which comes first? Do you think there's more people who just start believing that and thus increased media coverage? Or the increased media coverage, or is it even increased media coverage that leads to more people believing that? Or sharing about it. I don't know.
Let me try and unpick this one because this is complicated right now. There's it's very complicated. There is so I do not agree with the gradual sort of the constant undermining of the media that is happening, the sort of political attacks on the media that are happening right now. I think a free and fair press is like an absolute, it's like a human right. It's fundamental to a functioning society. However, I would also say that I think that one of the things that you notice when you move from the US, the UK to the US, is that the media is not a faction for reporting the news. It is so incredibly partisan and so incredibly exaggerated. The situation that we're in right now with, you know, like, you know, CNN, for example, screaming that, you know, they're not being taken seriously, and everyone like Trump saying that they're fake news. That was a construct of the media landscape in America. Like, they reported partisan news for a really long time, and now somebody is saying like, this isn't real. And everybody is, up in arms about it, but like it wasn't real. Fox News hasn't been real forever, and like, you know, MSNBC skews the other way, like increasingly left. So it is very, very hard when people have made an enormous amount of money off advertising revenue through spewing stories that are basically not legitimate or not in many cases like completely factual, to sort of, you know, the fact that everybody is now, so the sort of feeling under attack, I think, and, you know, it's so, so complicated. And I think the same thing is happening with these sort of fringe beliefs. There's so much attention being given to this sort of, you know, flat earthers, for example. Everyone's like, look at the crazies, like, look at these crazy people. And I'm just like, all you're doing with that is reaching more crazy people. You are amplifying crazy people, and you are serving to give a platform to these beliefs and this sort of other side-ism. Like, the flat earth thing is insane, because like, that is like, other side-ism taken to like its absolute like epic conclusion, which is like, the earth is round. You don't need to give airtime to the viewpoint that the earth is flat. You don't. It's fine, you know. So I think we're in a situation right now where like media, particularly in the US, is broken, and is trying to fix itself under enormous pressure, at a point where the advertising models, the financial models that underpin that news media, are wobbling and are rewarding extremism. So I don't know where we go from here. I don't have answers for this. I genuinely don't. And I think that the people who could, players like YouTube, when they eventually commit to solving seriously the problems that they have with like fringe beliefs and sort of hate speech and things like that are the best sort of current hope that we have. They just have to do it. Sorry, yeah, that was a rambling answer. I think
No. This is great. It's not an easy one. It's just like, I don't think that I didn't, as that's also why I framed it as a chicken and egg thing. There's not really any right answer to this thing.
I think it's a very
interesting point.
There's also the fact that like information abundance is basically driving everything right now. Information abundance is driving like finance and politics and news media. The fact that we have access to so much information and like that's not going away.
Yeah.
So how do we basically reconstruct a media apparatus around this notion of information abundance? I don't know, but I'm hoping people smarter than me are thinking about it.
Yeah. And one direction I was thinking where hopefully it's a point we might be able to talk about, and I don't know how involved or how relevant it is, but, and it's also back to your point earlier about people saying, well, I don't care anymore, because everything we're talking about can lead to, you know what, I'm just like, take me out. I'm not dealing with any of this thing anymore. I don't care about whatever we're talking about. And to reconnect people with some of their beliefs or things about social change. I saw that this was out of your LinkedIn, so I don't know how actual or how involved you are, but Papa La Caneta seemed to be a really interesting initiative. And I was wondering if that's something that you're still involved with.
Yes, I am still involved with it. And you should talk to Andre, who is he would say he's the chief connector. He doesn't like taking credit for things.
I'll reach out.
He's wonderful. So Papa La Caneta, Andre is a strategist in Brazil who fundamentally believes that there is like untapped creative and strategic capital in the advertising industry that could be put towards better use, sort of solving some big problems. And so his model of doing, he runs these kind of sprints, which are, you know, I have participated in a few of them and sort of facilitated and funded a couple of others. Basically, where you get together sort of a great spectrum of creative talent from lots of different agencies and strategic talent, and then you bring in activists who are working on the causes that you're going to be focused on. So whether it's trans rights or sort of reframing a perception around immigration, and then the creatives work together with the activists to come up with a solution to to that problem and to attempting to sort of start a dialogue or fix an issue that the activists are raising as an issue. And like honestly, it's been so fascinating, and the things that you learn from it, his model I think is exactly the right one, because quite often one of the things that I find slightly obnoxious about any kind of advertising for good work is it's generally conceived in a sort of bougie conference room by people who are nowhere close to the, you know, nowhere close to the actual issues at heart. And like being sitting with an amazing like trans community who are activists for their own right to be human and right to exist is, you know, was fascinating and heartbreaking and inspiring. And, you know, the working with them was just one of the most extraordinary experiences of my career. And I think that, you know, that's happened in sort of other instances. So he does, and he's done things with like, you know, sort of diversity in the advertising industry in Brazil. They were doing one about the plastic bag tax in New York, which has now just come in, which is great. It's just, it's a very diverse and interesting program. And it's the sort of thing that he doesn't want to turn it into a nonprofit. I'll let him talk about that. He doesn't want to sort of structure it. So, but I genuinely think that there should be more of it.
That's interesting. I'll definitely reach out and have a conversation with him because I love those kinds of initiatives. I don't know if you heard about it's a different kind of initiative, but I think there's similarities in a way that is interesting for Philippa White's International Exchange, if you heard of that one.
Oh, no, I haven't. Should I know about that?
Yeah, and I talked to her a few years ago. So the International Exchange is this, I think it's a business. I mean, I'm not sure if it's geared up as a nonprofit or not. I'm not certain. But anyway, what they do is they work with communications industries, media companies, and other types with people that are identified by leadership as kind of rising people, good performers, et cetera, but who might also be a little bit on getting bored or not feeling like whatever they're doing is not making any kind of difference. And those, they identify those people and then send them and match them up with typically a charity or a nonprofit or a very small business in often a developing or third world country, and send them out there for several months to say, well, you know, contribute your communication skills to this cause that these guys are working on in the Amazon.
That's so interesting. I feel
and it's developed as a leadership development project, and also get them out and get them to use those skills for, yeah, for better.
That sounds awesome. I feel like there's a lot of kind of overlap there. That sounds super interesting. I think there's it's one of the things that we have clients who are not nonprofit here who are enabling people to feel a sense of purpose in working with them. So we work with Planned Parenthood. We work with the Girl Scouts of America. We work with a lot of kind of ventures companies that are doing genuinely interesting stuff in the space. But these sort of separate projects, I think, are super helpful. Like making sure that you're working on stuff that you feel is genuinely meaningful is basically the key to everybody's happiness right now. So sounds like a great initiative.
That's great. Cool. All right. Well, this is a fantastic conversation, but just being conscious of your time, I'm going to move forward and start wrapping up. And the way I finish is usually with these cool down questions is what I'm calling them.
Come on, hit me. Let's do it.
It's the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. So let's start with a simple one. Do you have a favorite flavor?
Strawberry, but I can often get distracted by something with like a lot of chocolate in it.
Perfect. Is there another interest of mine is play and games. Is there a game that you enjoy or recommend playing? I don't know if you play games.
There is, and you might know it. Like there's a Dutch game, I think, called Rummy Cup, which is like the best game in the entire world. I have a massive thing about board games. And
Perfect.
Yes, no, I do. I'm like, I grew up in a household. My family holidays used to generally be like somewhere in like a hut in Wales in like the pouring rain. So me and my brother and sister played an enormous amount of card games and board games. And like, I never lost that love, but there is a Dutch game called Rummy Cup, which is all about, it's kind of like half dominoes, half like Mahjong kind of thing. And it's absolutely mesmerizing and you can play it for hours. So that would be my recommendation. Everyone should get a set. It's RUMMIQUB.
Yeah. I've seen it before, but I've never played. Is it a word game?
It's like a sort of tiles, kind of dominoes-ish sort of game, but it's basically unbelievably devilish and so, so addictive. I can't tell you.
Cool.
So I just came back from a family holiday where like everybody was playing all the time. So I think come to New York and we'll have a game.
All right. Awesome. Do you take notes? And if yes, how so? Or how do you take notes?
I have two forms of taking notes. I'm relentlessly analog. I find that digital interfaces do nothing for my attention span. So I'm basically relentlessly analog. I have a huge stack of Moleskines next to my desk. And also my meeting strategy to make things sure things are moving forward is usually to be the first person at the whiteboard.
Good. Perfect. What's the last piece of art or media that had an impact on you?
Oh, this is, you know, it's funny. I asked this question too. The last piece of art or media that had an impact on me, can I do two?
Yeah, sure.
So I think
we're running through this really faster than I thought, so we're fine.
Good. We're good. We'll talk about this. The thing that I always ask people is, what was the last thing you read or watched or listened to that you wanted to tell other people about?
Yeah.
There are two. There's a record just come out by a woman called a singer called Billie Eilish, who is the most Gen Z person that's ever happened. She's like a really interesting sort of slightly bratty singer-songwriter who works with her brother and produces this kind of very strange bedroom noises. And the record's huge. She's having a huge moment right now. She played at Coachella and like, the reason that I find her really interesting is she's one of the first artists in a really long time. She's blending a lot of influences in the way that Gen Z tends to. She's sort of breaking down a lot of walls between genres. And she's also starting to see, she's one of those people who's as in command of the way that she presents herself visually as she is sort of musically. And we used to have conversations here. I remember we were doing a project for, I think it was for Nike or Converse or someone about, they were interested in music and like what their music strategy should be. And one of our strategists said to me about this, I was just like, okay, so, you know, what do we think? What's our current point of view on music? And he said, well, the problem with music is that music itself is about the sixth most interesting thing in music right now. And what he meant was like all of the other stuff that follows it, like the image making, the sort of merch, the like tour drama, the sort of Twitter beefs, like all of that stuff, that infrastructure that exists around the cultural product of music is actually more interesting than music itself. And like, I found that absolutely fascinating. And Billie Eilish is one of those people that her mythos and styling, and like she just put her new video out yesterday, and it was Takashi Murakami like directed it. So she's pulling on these like strange influences for like a, you know, a sort of very young like internet artist. But
I have to check her out.
Oh, she's, yeah, and like she's like this unbelievable sort of cultural product of Gen Z that I think is super fascinating. And the music's kind of mesmerizing. It's very dark and very interesting. And yeah, she's fabulous.
And by the way, I remember you mentioning in a thing I found, you used to be in music production?
Oh yeah, I went to a music company for a little bit because I love music and I thought I wanted to work in it. And working in music production made me realize that it was okay just to love it. You didn't have to work in it. I think everyone's got one of those in their lives. Yeah. Probably like, but yes. But yeah, so there's that. And then there's also, I don't know if you've seen this because this is quite sort of dark. And this is, obviously everyone in the office is watching Game of Thrones, which is, I think, is the last collective viewing moment of like all the postmodern era. I don't think this is going to happen again, basically, the fact that everybody's on it. But the one that I was going to talk about, because from a storytelling perspective, I just thought it was fascinating. I don't know if you've seen Leaving Neverland, the HBO Michael Jackson.
No, I read a long article the moment it was coming out at the Sundance Festival, but I didn't see the actual movie yet. Just reading the article was like sickening, and I was like, I don't know if I'll be ready to watch some documentary at all. Yeah. So I should, but you know,
it's really harrowing. And so the thing that I found really interesting about it is one, it's like, it is a successful destruction of a legacy. Like, I think his legacy, in my humble opinion, deserves to be destroyed, because I think the way that those stories are told, and the way that the director dedicates so much patience and so much time to these two men who have to tell their stories, and it's just their stories for sort of almost 3 hours, just them talking to camera and them sort of like, and you hear from their family a little bit, but like it's mostly just them. And it was such a sort of narrative construct. It made me realize how long it had been since I'd sort of seen a story given this much patience and given this much room to grow. And there isn't an attempt to sort of other side the whole thing. Like, they talked to the Jackson estate and then felt like they didn't want to include their perspectives because this was a story about the victims. And I think in the era that we're in right now, where we're finding out that actually far more people are victims of sexual abuse and harassment than potentially was known before, watching this storytelling and watching the victims kind of carefully pick through and process what happened to them, I think just made it like an incredible artifact. I think people are going to be like looking back at that for years to come on a sort of like, one, how was this enabled? Like, two, how are we not listening? And, you know, three, like, how is it possible that we can use media to afford victims more respect? So it came, it raised a lot of very interesting questions for me. And like, it was, you know, came out just after the Christina Blasey Ford went to testify in front of Congress. Yep. And sort of shouted down in every way possible. And this was just the opposite of that. This is like what happens when victims are allowed to tell their stories with love and respect. And I have never seen anything like it. And it's an extraordinary piece of filmmaking. So a weird one, but.
Thank you.
Worthwhile. Now, this is for its formative. Yeah, it's doing interesting things with form, I think.
Well, all right, I'll watch it. Thank you. This is brilliant.
Of course.
Last question. If you could make a wish and you could give something, a thing to everyone, and that you just wish it and they all have it, what might that be?
Does it have to be a tangible thing?
No, it could be just to use a word, something you give it to everyone.
Empathy.
Awesome.
I think that tying back to our conversation before, the gift of empathy, that would be wonderful.
Yeah. Well, it's a perfect place to end. Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time.
No.
Where can people find you online and get in touch if there were anything like it?
Yes, Greenwood on everything. I tend to be sort of on and off the social media depending on how busy I am. But like Twitter on Jess Greenwood is great. And I am eminently findable on LinkedIn. And LinkedIn and Twitter are the best places to find me. Jess Greenwood.
Perfect. Perfect. Thank you so much for your time.
No worries. Thank you, Willem. This has been great.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. That's another episode wrapping up. Thank you very much for listening. I really appreciate your time. And if you're still listening to this point, I'm guessing you enjoyed the episode enough to be listening to this particular side. So I will reiterate what I said at the beginning of the show. It makes really a big difference to for other people to find the show and for me to essentially be encouraged to know that there's people appreciating out there. Because otherwise, the only interaction I have is numbers of downloads for and see spikes, and it just doesn't really tell me much. And I obviously don't have millions of people downloading, but anyway, it makes more of a difference to know that there's a few people that are really enjoying this. And if you post a review, it allows other people to find the podcast because of algorithm magic. And, you know, if you're giving me a 5-star review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or your phone app, then it lets other people that might have the same kind of interest as you find the podcast, essentially. So, yeah. And if you're interested in my experiment of playing tabletop role-playing games virtually or inviting me to your office, if you want to invite me over to organize a game or similarly, if you want to, rather than a game, organize a branding workshop and strategy and talk about how is it that I'm including elements from storytelling and role-playing games in my strategy work when I can and when I convince people that it's a good idea, which does happen. I know that sounded weird. I don't know why I'm saying defensive about it. But anyway, it's still an ongoing process. And that's something that it is close to my heart. So I want to put more effort into it. And I find myself, you know, being busy with everything else that's going on. And that kind of takes a back burner from time to time. And the podcast sometimes suffers from the same thing, as you may realize. But anyway, I really appreciate you listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Share it with people far and wide. Get in touch. On the website, that's icecreamforeveryone.net or Willem, W-I-L-L-E-M, at icecreamforeveryone.net. On Twitter, it's ICWillem, letters I and C, and W-I-L-L-E-M for my full name. That's about it. Have a fantastic evening, morning, afternoon, night, whatever time of day or night it is for you. All right, thanks. Bye.